Well, we're going to give you a real treat. Two special topics here with Les Klinger. We're going to talk about, of course, H.P. Lovecraft and his horror works, and then Sherlock Holmes on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Les Klinger, of course, is considered to be one of the world's foremost authorities on two icons, Sherlock Holmes and Dracula. Since the 1960s, the study of the rich, fantastic literature of the Victorian writers has been Klinger's consuming passion. And Les, what a great passion it is. You do a great job, my friend. Thank you.
Thanks. It's so nice to be back on the show.
It is. It's been 6 years. Is that correct?
Wow.
Time goes by when you're having fun.
It does. I've found some new topics, some new things to drop footnotes on, and it's still fun.
So we'll talk about two icons tonight. We'll talk about H.P. Lovecraft and, of course, Sherlock Holmes and in that case as well. But Lovecraft, he died in 1937. Wasn't very old, 46, 47 years old. But what can you tell us about him?
Well, a strange guy, George. This is a fellow who, in many ways, was almost the classic example of the starving writer. He was born and raised in Providence, Rhode Island. He left Rhode Island exactly once in his life, as far as a residence. He moved to New York for 2 years, hated living in New York. We'll come back to that and talk about his racist attitudes. But he hated living in New York, moved back to Providence, where he spent the rest of his life. He wrote almost exclusively for himself. He was a terrible commercial failure as a writer. His stories appeared primarily in either amateur journals. He was part of a group called the Amateur Press Movement, or in what were then called the pulp magazines, the cheap magazines like Weird Tales, that had stories of science fiction and horror and creepy mysteries and adventure and all that, paid very little, and was largely read by young boys and hardcore fans of these genres. He was really almost a complete failure during his lifetime. He had one book published. It was a single short story only. He never had a collection of his stories published during his lifetime.
Huh.
After his death, his friends, the circle of friends that he had formed and that appreciated his work, began to publish his work and began to get him in front of his work in front of critics. And it was appreciated slowly. And eventually, by the 70s, the word was spreading that he was a fine writer. And his work became very influential. It was a tremendous influence on modern writers like Clive Barker, Stephen King, Neil Gaiman, Peter Straub. These are writers who grew up reading Lovecraft, admired his work, and adapted it to their own ends.
Yet he's dead, and so unless you believe in the afterlife, the poor guy never got the recognition and the credit, did he?
That's really true. And the first great milestone for him and his career was an edition of his stories published by the Library of America not that long ago. That was really sort of the apotheosis of Lovecraft, is that he finally got recognized as essentially equivalent to Edgar Allan Poe, as a great American writer of horror and a master of the short story. And then, frankly, I'm not patting myself on the back, but the fact that Norton wanted to publish this new book that I've done is another great milestone, and the Lovecraft community recognizes that.
And it moves on. So some of Lovecraft's works, which ones do you say are the best?
Well, my favorite is a novella called At the Mountains of Madness. It's really a very early science fiction story, more than a horror story. It's about an Arctic expedition, an Antarctic expedition, that makes some strange discoveries. I always say that the greatest Lovecraft film ever made is not really a Lovecraft story, but it's the movie The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing.
I remember that. That's right.
Very similar to the story at the Mountains of Madness. That's one of his classic stories. The Call of Cthulhu is another very famous, very influential story about, and I see that on your website, you have a wonderful drawing of Cthulhu that Lovecraft himself made. Cthulhu being an elder god, a strange alien being that is somehow awakening, and his telepathic signal is going out to people all over the world. A very strange story. Lovecraft stories are all really interesting in that the narrators are almost anonymous, almost. They're colorless individuals.
Are they like outsiders looking in?
They are, in many cases, they're academics. He's got professors who discover things that they really shouldn't find out.
And as he dabbles with them and they unfold their stories, are they tales of weaving mysteries? Because, you know, as we've been billing this, the guy was one of the greatest horror writers ever. What got him to write that way?
Well, he was fascinated by science. He was growing up at a time, by the way, he was also fascinated by Sherlock Holmes, but that's another
subject. We'll get into that.
We will. He was a very serious amateur astronomer, and he was a real student of the science of the day. And the more he learned about astronomy and physics, the more he became impressed that humankind was almost an insignificant speck in the universe. We have this grand self, the grand sense that we're the center of the universe, but Lovecraft felt that we were the opposite. We were just little puppets in this grand drama that was the cosmos. And so he created what he called cosmic horror. And that's what happens in almost each of the stories, that the narrator gets a perspective on what's going on around him, or mostly him. There's very few women in the stories, realizing how insignificant humans are and how scary and hostile the universe is.
No question about that. What did he die of, Les?
He died of stomach cancer. It was very sad, very painful. He actually kept a death diary of his symptoms and his treatment for the last few weeks of his life, and it's really horrific reading. I don't want him to come across as a recluse or a hermit. He was a guy who isolated himself in Rhode Island, but he carried on an extensive correspondence with a wide circle of friends. This is a man who may have written 100,000 letters during his lifetime.
Wow. Was he married? Did he have a relationship?
Very strange. He married a woman named Sonia Green. And the reason it was strange was because, first of all, he didn't seem to have much interest in women up until the time that that they married. And second, she was Jewish. Now, Lovecraft was avowedly anti-Semitic, racist, bigoted, regarded all of those people who weren't white Anglo-Saxon Protestants from Rhode Island.
He hated everybody.
He did. They were all mongrels. So
jeez.
How did he sell
books in the beginning, Les.
Well, interesting, the stories themselves are not particularly racist. There's a few hints in the stories of his attitudes, but those attitudes were mostly expressed in his letters. But he excused his wife Sonia and a few other friends as being Jews who had assimilated. They were good Jews. They had given up all their Jewishness and had fit into society.
he could overlook that, right?
But when he was spending time in New York, his 2 years in New York, I mean, he was like foaming at the mouth, upset at the mongrel population around him, the Filipinos, the Italians, the blacks. They were just despicable people in his view. I think that although the stories aren't overtly racist, that feeling that he had, that he was oppressed, alienated, alone in the universe, fighting the good fight, comes across in the stories. I think it really powers the stories. It's a very unfortunate aspect of his character, and we can't excuse it. But without it, I don't think we get the powerful stories that he'd created.
Were there any movies made from his books?
There's been a handful over the years. They're generally very poor films, with the exception of some films made by the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society. The reason, I think, is that the stories are largely unfilmable. He's writing about things that characteristically calls the unnameable. So it's impossible to really depict the horror on screen. And his stories are slow. They're about mood. They're not action pieces. They're really not suited to the film industry.
We're dear friends with the sci-fi writer, Jerry Pornell, and Larry Niven. And Jerry, you know, sends me emails all the time. What would someone like Jerry Pornell have said about Lovecraft's works?
Oh, I think they would love it. I think they would have said, Jerry or Larry Niven, and I know Larry as well, you know, you read some of their work, and it's clearly been influenced by Lovecraft. They've got that sense that no matter how much science you use, at the core of things, you're going to find something inexplicable. You're going to find something that's going to scare the devil out of you. And the science is great. It may prepare you for it or lead you to it, but it's not going to make everything neat and safe.
How many great authors, Les, die and don't get the recognition they deserve when they're living?
How many? Well, probably more, a lot more than they should. But I think that that's changed to some extent now. I think that it's so much easier to publish or to sort of spread the news. It's very interesting to compare Lovecraft's circle of friends with the modern internet community. Lovecraft essentially created his own paper internet. The amateur journal, the United Press Association, of which he ended up being president, had occasional conventions. But this was a group of people who largely self-published magazines containing each other's work. And that was the outlet for a lot of these writers. And it was a very lively community, very active. Not saying the writing was particularly great, but it gave an outlet to these people. I think the internet has done a lot of that today for many people. They can write, they can publish their stuff, and they don't have to worry about whether they can meet the standards of some commercial publisher. So I don't think it's changed that it's hard to get commercial success, but we have new outlets for writing that Lovecraft never had, and I think so it's even more widespread than it was then.
Let's move on for a moment. And by the way, the name of your book on Lovecraft, of course, is The New Annotated H.P. Lovecraft. But you also have The New Annotated Dracula, which I want to talk with you about next hour, and The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes as well. Tell me about your fascination with Sherlock Holmes.
Well, I got hooked on Sherlock Holmes when I was in law school many, many years ago. Back in 1968... I received a gift of the wonderful annotated Sherlock Holmes by William S. Baring Gould. This was really one of the very first popular annotated books. And I was hooked partly by Sherlock Holmes, partly by the character of Holmes and the charm of the stories. But I was also hooked by the footnotes. Just the whole idea of annotating was exciting to me. It sounds really weird, but it was exciting to me to discover the cult of intense fandom that was fascinated by Sherlock Holmes, and I wanted to be part of that. I wanted to sort of be in the club and part of that game, and so I started many, many years ago, and then got lucky in the 90s and started to publish my own efforts at doing that, and eventually that led to the Norton book, and it's been great fun ever since.
And Sherlock Holmes was the real deal, wasn't he?
Well, yeah. I mean, Sherlock Holmes has been around. It's funny. Everybody asks me, how did I pick such trendy topics to write books about? Trendy, yeah. Well, Sherlock Holmes has been trendy for more than 100 years. I mean, it's hard for us to sort of put ourselves into the place of the Victorian readers and understand the phenomenon of Sherlock Holmes. Harry Potter is probably the only thing today that comes even close to the intensity and huge readership of those stories when they first began to appear in the 1890s and early 1900s. And, you know, this is an era with no television or radio and no film, so books were it. That's what got people excited.
Well, Holmes, though, was a fictional character, but was he based on some real person?
Well, first of all, the Sherlockians like to play a game, the game, that Holmes was not a fictional character, that Holmes right. was a real person, that Dr. Watson was a real person who wrote biographical accounts of his life. Were there people on whom Conan Doyle modeled Sherlock Holmes? Yes. There was, first of all, his medical instructor, Dr. Joseph Bell, who taught Doyle about observation and making deductions from minute observations. There was a whole rising detective force in England that was partly a model for this. Doyle freely admitted that he took some ideas from Edgar Allan Poe's character, Chevalier Auguste Dupin, the detective who's in Murders in the Rue Morgue and two other stories. So there were plenty of models for Sherlock Holmes, but he's really his own man in so many ways. Doyle was a genius in creating that character.
You sued the Doyle estate, didn't you?
I did. And
what happened?
Well, so my friend Laurie King and I, in 2011, published a collection of short stories, or wanted to publish a collection of short stories called A Study in Sherlock. This was a series of new stories written by a number of friends of ours, major mystery writers. And in the course of doing that, the Conan Doyle Estate Limited, which is a company owned by some grandnieces and grandnephews of Arthur Conan Doyle. Conan Doyle has no living direct descendants anymore.
Nothing. Okay.
So that company contacted the publisher, Random House, and said, you can't do this without a license. Now, their argument was that although 50 of the 60 Sherlock Holmes stories are no longer protected by copyright in the United States and are free of copyright everywhere in the rest of the world, 10 of the stories in the U.S. remain in copyright, and that because the estate owned the rights to those 10 stories, as they clearly do, they had the right to protect the character. You could not make up, they said, a new story about Sherlock Holmes so long as their copyright remained on those 10 stories.
Hmm.
We said that was wrong. We said that was contrary to existing law, and we didn't think we needed to take out a license. Random House, the publisher, disagreed. They didn't want to fight about it. They just wanted to pay a license fee and move on.
Right.
So now we came to 2012. We were the new publisher, Pegasus Books, a fine small press. And we were going to do a second volume. And once again, the estate contacted the publisher and said, you need a license, or else we're going to work with Barnes & Noble and Amazon and those kinds of distributors, and we'll stop you from selling the book.
And they bend very fast. You know that.
They absolutely do. They don't want to be in trouble. So at that point, we scratched our heads and talked between ourselves what we were going to do, and we decided that we had to file a lawsuit asking not for money damages, but for what's called declaratory relief. We asked the district court to determine, the federal district court of Northern Illinois, that's where the estate had an office, to rule that we were correct, that we did not need a license, that the character was free of copyright protection. And that's what the court said. The court said in December of 2013 that if we didn't use story elements that appeared only in the 10 copyrighted stories, as long as we stuck to material that was in the 50 stories, we didn't.
Hold on, Leslie. We'll come back, talk a little bit more about Sherlock Holmes, then Dracula on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest, Les Klinger, as we talk about, of course, the life of Sherlock Holmes. We're going to talk about Dracula, too, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Les Klinger with us. Before we get into Dracula, we'll continue talking about Sherlock Holmes a little bit. And, of course, his latest book called H.P. Lovecraft is available to you as well, which is always a fascinating read. When you write these stories, Les, about these authors, do you do it almost as if you're there with them?
I try. I want to get into their heads. I want to understand why they wrote what they wrote. And all of these people now, whether it's Bram Stoker or Arthur Conan Doyle or H.P. Lovecraft, lived in times that are remote from us. We can't remember the Victorian age. We have difficulty even remembering the 1920s and 1930s when Lovecraft was writing most of his stories. And so I want to try and explore the cultural history, the popular influences around them. I'm not an English major anymore. I'm not a PhD. I'm trying to add what I think of as almost sort of the bonus track on the DVD, you know, the director's track, where somebody is whispering in your ear as you're reading the story, saying, look at that. Isn't that cool? Isn't that interesting?
What was your fascination with Sherlock Holmes? What made that character what he is?
I think what interested me most was that there was this vast body of Sherlockians who were themselves fascinated with Sherlock Holmes, fascinated with the puzzles of the stories, and wanting to live in that era in their minds and share those adventures. And so I wanted to explore that. Holmes himself, I think, is a fascinating character because, and not so much because he's a great detective. Nobody reads those stories anymore for the mysteries, because today we see them as cliched. But he's a fascinating character because he's always the smartest person in the room. He's in charge. He is incorruptible. He's always focused on doing the right thing. And I think that's really appealing to us. We think we'd like to be like Sherlock Holmes.
And what about Watson?
Oh, that I think is Conan Doyle's great invention. Dupin, the detective character created by Poe, was equally a great deducer, a great analyst of facts. But he's kind of colorless, and his friend is even more colorless. Watson is this wonderful human character that we can empathize with. And I think if we're honest, we'd like to be Dr. Watson, really, not Sherlock Holmes. We get to hang around with Holmes. We get to leave at the end of the day.
Right.
Holmes isn't always the nicest person to be around.
But we get to have the fun stuff with him, too,
absolutely,
if you're Watson.
Absolutely.
How did those two, at least in character, get to know each other?
Well, almost by accident. They were both looking for flatmates, roommates. Holmes was quite young. In 1881, when he meets Dr. Watson, he's probably only in his mid-20s, 26 or 27. Watson is a year or two older, just back from the Afghanistan War. Doesn't that sound familiar?
That's way back. That's right.
And
that's what made Kiplinger, right?
Yes. And he is back from the wars. He's been wounded. He doesn't have a lot of money. He's looking for an inexpensive way to live. And a mutual friend puts them together. And in the beginning, Watson does not know what to make of his roommate, who has all these strange people come see him all the time. And slowly he learns that Holmes is trying to make a living as the world's first consulting detective.
And by the way, it's Kipling. I was thinking of the Kiplinger newsletter for a moment.
Right. Rudyard Kipling, yes. One of the great writers of the empire.
Would you consider Rudyard Kipling as part of the same group?
Absolutely. There was a circle of friends in London that included Conan Doyle, Kipling, and Bram Stoker. They were all part of that small literary circle of sort of young men who were making a name for themselves in literature. Kipling was certainly the most commercially successful at the time. Conan Doyle was very close behind. The two of them were far and away making a lot more money than any other writers of the day. But Bram Stoker was the manager of the Lyceum Theater and really the center of a universe of celebrities and literary figures.
And let's move in then to Dracula and how that occurred through Stoker. What happened?
Well, Stoker started out as a writer. He was a theater critic in the beginning, which is how he got to London, because Sir Henry Irving asked him to come manage his theater for him. But he always wanted to try his hand at writing. He ended up writing 14 books during his life, a number of short stories. But one book alone got most of his energy. He spent 7 years crafting this novel called Dracula. And it's remarkable because it's so head and shoulders above anything else he ever did. It just was a powerful, compelling, disgusting, fascinating story.
Romantic.
About this master vampire. And he absorbed a lot of folklore, and there was a tradition already of vampires in English literature. The two great ones, The Vampire is the name of a book by John Polidori that came out in 1819. There was another great successful Penny Dreadful called Varney the Vampire that had come out in the mid-century. And the population loved the ideas of vampires. There was a popular creature of sort of myth. But nobody had written a great story about a compelling figure like Dracula until Stoker came along.
And that came out in 1897, didn't it?
Yes. And, you know, sort of never out of print since. And really laid down the rules for this huge genre now of vampire fiction. Never bettered, often imitated. And just this, you know, landmark, monumental book.
And Frankenstein came out way before that, didn't it?
Yes, Frankenstein came out, first edition was in 1818. Funny you should mention that, George. It's my next book, is the new edition
of
Frankenstein.
I love it.
First edition came out in 1818. A second edition, revised, came out in 1831. So many years before Dracula. But interestingly, like both Polidori's The Vampire and Varney the Vampire, all three of those stories, Frankenstein and those two, were tremendous stage successes. There were numerous copycat plays that were very, very popular in the 19th century. So it wasn't just the book. It was also sort of the large figures of those characters that were very much in the public eye.
Well, we didn't have radio. We didn't have television. The only outlet for people, books, newspapers, and the theater.
Yes.
And so I would guess it really would have taken off.
Absolutely. And in many cases, it's sort of pirate versions, too. The authors of the books didn't necessarily make the money from the success of the stage plays. It was other people who sort of ripped off their ideas. But those figures very much resonated in the public eye. And clearly, when Stoker got around to writing Dracula, he was well aware of those earlier important vampire figures, and certainly of the success of Frankenstein.
Was Nosferatu already out?
Oh, no, that's much later. That came out in 1920. And that was a film by the great German expressionist F.W. Murnau, who actually wanted to make a film of the book Dracula, but couldn't get the rights from Florence Stoker, Bram Stoker's widow, went ahead and ripped off the book anyway, put out the film. Florence tried to block distribution of the film and thought that all the copies were destroyed. Fortunately, a few remained, and that masterpiece has now been it's all over the internet on YouTube and things like that. But no, that came much later. But interestingly, Nosferatu set the one rule that everybody knows about vampires that wasn't in Dracula, and that is that vampires are destroyed by sunlight. That's the invention of Murnau.
Okay.
Doesn't appear in the original Dracula.
And what about the attractiveness of the character? Because in Nosferatu, this was a hideous-looking creature.
Well, but that's really true. That's closer to the book than most people remember. The book describes Dracula as a tall, thin old man with long fingernails, foul breath. because, of course, he's dead, and a long, drooping white mustache and all that. Not particularly attractive figure. It was the stage play that completely revolutionized that in the 1920s when he was first cast with the way we think of Dracula now. The tails, the opera hat,
right.
Suave, slick back hair.
The nice accent. Hello there.
Yes, and, sort of good-looking, romantic figure. That was really a creature of the stage, and you're right. It's totally different from Nosferatu. And, of course, Bela Lugosi, this unknown actor who took the part in America, first on the stage, and then reluctantly, the producers didn't want to use him, cast as the part in the film, became the image.
It made his career, didn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. And made everybody's image of the vampire change into this sort of lounge lizard romantic figure.
Well, how did Bram come up with the idea?
He said he had a nightmare because he had eaten too much stuffed crab.
Or garlic.
Yes, he said that he had dreamt about a king vampire and that was what inspired him. But I think it was a lot of things. I think he knew the literature. He was raised in Ireland by an Irish mother who clearly had told him lots of legends. And so he absorbed a lot of the folklore, did a lot of research about the folklore, made up a lot of stuff, too, and created that figure.
How much of your work is based on Dracula? How much of it is based on simply Bram Stoker?
Mostly it's both. I tried in my notes to explore all of that.
Okay.
One of the things I got to do was look at the manuscript of Dracula, which was really cool. So I wanted to look at both the origins and Stoker's inventions.
Unlike Lovecraft, was Stoker a hero while he was still alive in terms of a literary hero?
Yes. The book, not only was he very successful at his job, which was, as I said, managing the Lyceum Theater, he was very popular. And the book, although the first printing of Dracula was not a huge commercial success, it did well. It did reasonably well. He didn't die with a lot of money. He lived a good life and
he spent what he made.
Yeah, but Lovecraft was basically scrabbling to earn enough money to pay for food. One of the things that Lovecraft got into was what are now called revisions. He actually hired out his services to rewrite stories for other writers who would then put out the stories under their own names. Those stories, a few of them attribute Lovecraft as a co-writer, but that helped him put food on the table. Stoker was a high-living, successful guy.
So who would you say of the three authors we've been talking about, Doyle, Stoker, or Lovecraft, who would you say was the best?
Well, that's a tough question. Lovecraft is in many ways the finest craftsman of the group, meticulous artist about his choices of words, the moods he was trying to create, and all that. Conan Doyle, who is probably of the three, it's very hard to say. They're all hugely influential. I mean, everybody has suffered from the Dracula syndrome in writing their vampire stories. Every detective, mystery writer, crime writer since Doyle has had to live with the rules, the way that Sherlock Holmes operated, and how he changed detective fiction. Lovecraft's influence was more subtle. Doyle had very little regard for his craft. He hated the character of Sherlock Holmes. He regarded it as cheap, easy writing that was keeping him from the good stuff that he wanted to write. But he was a genius at short stories, even though he didn't put a lot of time and effort into those stories. Stoker spent a lot of time on Dracula, and it did show. He polished and polished it, and it came out well. All three of them, hugely influential. I can't imagine those fields of literature without those giants.
Well, now, how would you categorize Mary Shelley when you write the Frankenstein book?
Shelley is a remarkable writer, in part because she was so darn young when that book came out. She was She was 19 years old when she was composing the book, born in 1897. And the book, she finished writing it in 1816, and then it finally came out in 1818. And she was a genius. She was the child of two great towering intellectual figures of the day, William Godwin and Mary Wollstonecraft, both intellectuals, revolutionaries almost in thinking. And so it was expected that she would be prodigal in terms of her abilities and all that. But even so, Frankenstein is just a remarkable achievement. It's taught now across the board in curricula, in gender studies, women's studies, history of science fiction. It's often called the first science fiction novel. Of course, horror fiction. It's a remarkable book. And it's remarkable in part because it's so different from the movie. It's so different from what people think the book is about. The book is really about the perils of trying to bring about a child in the world without a mother, with a father, an arrogant father who thinks he can do it by himself, and then totally abdicates his responsibility.
Yeah. And yet this story of Frankenstein made Bela Lugosi as Dracula made Boris Karloff as Dracula made Bela Lugosi.
Certainly. But again, Frankenstein was widely portrayed on the stage. There were great stage actors in the 19th century who made their career playing either Victor Frankenstein, the mad scientist, or the creature. But yes, Karloff, it became indelibly associated with him, just as, say, Basil Rathbone became typecast as Sherlock Holmes and Lugosi as Dracula. Karloff was, for the rest of his career, Frankenstein's monster.
Favorite writer of all times, Les? Who?
Oh, wow. Well, J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yeah.
Another genius who created larger-than-life figures.
Was he getting the recognition he deserved?
Tolkien was little known, really, until I'm old enough to remember in the 60s when the Ballantine paperback editions came out, and suddenly everybody was reading Lord of the Rings. I, like everybody else, had my Welcome to Middle-Earth poster on my wall in my college dorm, and had my Frodo Lives bumper sticker. So it took a long time. I mean, those books were published in the 1930s, and it took 30 years for them to get public recognition. Of course, now they're everywhere.
How easy was book publishing back in the 1800s, 1900s?
It wasn't. There were a lot of publishers, and there was a tradition of publishing what we would now call self-publishing, too. I mean, you could go to a publisher and say, look, I've got together 20 friends who will buy copies of the book. Would you print it for us?
Right, or you give him a check or something, and
right,
he prints it. Yeah.
Right. So it wasn't that hard to get published. It was very hard to get attention, just as it is today. And the author's situations have not changed a great deal. Conan Doyle was a member of the Authors Club, and there's a famous painting showing this enormous fat figure of a publisher and the author sitting sort of cowering at the feet of the publisher.
Yeah, they were something else in those days. Les, we're going to come back and take some phone calls, final hour with you here, as we talk about some of your fascinating work. It truly is, of course, the new annotated H.P. Lovecraft, the new annotated Dracula, and the new annotated Sherlock Holmes. He's got those three, and eventually throw Frankenstein into the mix. We'll be back.